This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi.
Featuring author, psychologist, and daily contributor, Siobhan Scott.
The trial of Richard Allen coming up very quickly in the Delphi murder case. And one of the big points of it is the confessions, multiple confessions from Richard Allen to all sorts of people, not just mom, not just his wife, but guards, other inmates, and lots of people. We're hearing it over and over. But if you look at the actual reports of the confessions, it's not just a confession. It's a confession that's then followed up with other information about the crime itself. However, the crime he's describing is not the crime that was committed. So how legit are those confessions? Joining me to discuss, psychotherapist and author Siobhan Scott. We all know that there are false confessions that take place out there. But with Richard Allen, we've been hearing more about them. We've been hearing about he was in solitary confinement for a year, basically. And there was people always taking notes and taunting him and yelling at him, "You're a killer, you're child killer," this and that. And eventually he starts admitting to this crime. But then he also says, "And then I shot one of them this way. Then I sexually assaulted one of them." That didn't happen. That's not how the crime took place. How does that then weigh in with a confession when what he's confessing to also doesn't add up?
Yeah, I've taken a deep dive into the research on false confessions recently.
Yeah.
And we know that there have been many, because there were several hundred cases after we started doing DNA analysis, several hundred cases of crimes where people had been convicted based upon all kinds of evidence, including faulty witness testimony, as we've talked about how common that is. And then they were found later on to be innocent by DNA. Now, 70% of those cases, 12% of all the cases were cases where the person had actually made a confession that could not have been true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, out of that 12%, 70% were people who were the victims of coercive police tactics. So they had been yelled at, or they had been promised immunity, something manipulative.
Yeah.
But 30% of the false confessions were people who were either psychotic or mentally retarded. They had some kind of mental impairment.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have been hallucinating or having delusions that they actually did the crime.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that you have to consider, especially with a person like Richard Allen, who has been determined by his own attorneys at this point to be having symptoms of gross psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
So he's been reported to be eating his feces. He's paranoid. He's having hallucinations. So what does a confession mean in someone who's got symptoms like that? You have to really look at the totality of all of it. And yes, at the confessions coming out in bizarre ways, in ways that are inconsistent, that's incredibly relevant. Now, that still is not proof that he didn't do it, because as I've said, when you look at the bizarre staging of the crime, it was so strange. It speaks to me of a perpetrator who was psychotic, because it was so weird.
Yeah.
And so if it's not Richard Allen, who's psychotic at this point, I think there's another perpetrator out there who had certainly some psychotic tendencies or a psychotic episode. But it's a fascinating case, and one that, yeah, we have to really take it apart and look at it carefully. What's being said, under what circumstances, and, you know, how does this all gel?
And as far as we know, prior to his incarceration in a prison in solitary confinement, he wasn't psychotic. He was working at the CVS for many years. He's the one who admitted that he was over there that day. And even early on in some of the questioning, which, of course, has conveniently been deleted at certain points from from record, what we do know is that he said, "I didn't do this. I have nothing to do with this. I'm not going to be your patsy. I'm not going to go down for this because you need to frame somebody. I'm just not." But then they start breaking him down. and those psychological tactics that were used are extremely questionable. And obviously, different investigators have different tactics. In some countries, you just can't do that. It's they find it to be, you know, abhorrent because it doesn't necessarily lead to any sort of accurate information other than what the interviewer wants to get. And you know, if you push somebody enough, you'll probably get them to say whatever you want. They'll tell you they're a cat. But if you don't and you use other tactics, you may get more accurate information. Why do we do this? Why do we, when we know that these sort of tactics don't work very effectively, why do we still employ them in our country or allow it to be employed by some investigators when questioning a suspect?
Yeah, it's really, really awful. And I think it's one of those things where people trust the system. Your average person trusts the system and thinks it's fair. And that when we talk about the justice system, it really is all about justice. And when you start taking it apart, no, it's adversarial. And it's usually not about really getting to the truth. It's about either getting a conviction or an exoneration, depending on which side you're on. And why we're behind in a lot of other countries in many things is questionable, but I think it's something that, you know, most citizens don't really think about or pay attention to unless it hits them personally. And it would probably behoove us all to gain more education about it.
The idea of being in solitary confinement, I mean, that it's a scary thought, but it's a reality for some people, and it's very scary, especially if you are innocent. I'm not saying he is. We obviously don't know that, but anybody in those conditions, innocent or guilty of a crime, that's going to break you down. I mean, and let's talk about that for a minute. How quick does that take place? And what's going on in one's mind when they're isolated from the world for that long of a period of time? And then on top of that, you have the taunting, you have guards, you have other inmates that are mentally torturing you. I mean, that's really what we have going on here in our system. And again, it's kind of one of those things. I don't think most people in our society realize that. They think, oh, he's having his lunch and he's just in a small room. And, you know, that's not the case.
Yeah, there's so much about the prison system here that I think is inhumane, and certainly solitary confinement is one of those things. And the irony is a lot of people are put in solitary confinement supposedly to keep them safe, you know, and it's actually very hard on people psychologically. How long we can withstand a stressor like that is really unique. Some people actually can go a long time and not suffer that much from it, but other people are much more fragile. In fact, a lot of people have a breakdown just being incarcerated at all. You know, it can be very, very stressful for people. I think they start having perceptual distortions and start misperceiving the world, and they can get very confused.
So when you have someone like this making these confessions, and let's just say he did not do it, what leads them to start saying those sort of things out loud? Do they start to believe that they did it, or are they doing it out of duress, of threats sometimes? I'm sure that could be a motive, but are they actually, I mean, is it going through their mind? Yeah, I did do this. Like where he comes out and then started saying these other parts of the crime that didn't even take place.
Yeah, I think in this case, because he's having so many gross symptoms of psychosis, that he may be delusional and actually believe that he did it. And that could be why the stories change all the time, because he's coming up with various, you know, scenarios based upon delusional thinking. And that could certainly be happening. So a lot of the other, as I said, 30% of the false confessions, the person really believes they did it at the time they make the confession, when it's proven later on that, no, they didn't.
Let's go down the road and continue where saying he didn't do it, and we don't know, but let's just say he did not do it, and they don't convict him. He ends up being exonerated. How does someone like that come back from something like this? Obviously, I would imagine it's a scar that's going to last the rest of his life to a certain extent, but once you've gone so far down that road, is there any coming back?
I think I would guess a person in this situation, if they get out of that threatening environment, they're going to need to be on medication. They're going to need support, probably a supportive living situation. I don't know that just living back with their spouse, if they're having these kind of symptoms, is going to work for them. But I do think people can recover, but it would take time. And that's, again, going to be a really unique individual path for each person.
Sick of the ads?
We opt to.
Start listening with no commercials now and get access to all of our episodes in advance of everyone else.
Become a True Crime Today Premium Plus subscriber on Apple Podcasts.
Search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts or go to our podcast page and sign up now.
True Crime Today Premium Plus.
Sign up now.